in theory. And in any case, if the light comes after us, we'll evacuate you and the civilians. Surely, if you helped them survive in the hunt, the villagers would be more willing to help you hide in Staravos. That was the final nail in Zachary's coffin. The priest mulled it over and began to nod slowly.
Remember, Ed told him, let's start slow. How about some holy water to begin with? My friends and I will hunt dangerous undead soon, and we could use the light's blessing.
Yes, yes, I can help you with that. I suppose Oinus will be pleased to take part in hunting undead. They're terrible for business.
What do you need?
Purified water, said Zachary. It works better if cleansed by a cleric's spells that same day, but using non-divine water treatment methods could do in a pinch. As a priest, I've no magic of my own, so I'll have to bless it using rituals.
A long technical explanation followed. Ed pieced together that Zachary could only make about 1 liter of holy water per day, and it'd only remain blessed for up to a week without a cleric's magic. If Ed got the priest an assistant, he could make more and make it last longer. Blessing weaponry was faster. The ritual took an hour, but the blessing only lasted for a day, and it could be lost if the weapon drew blood from a living vein. When Ed complained about the unfairness of that last limitation, Zachary explained that permanent blessings required a payment of experience points, along with special alloys of steel and silver known only to the Inquisition, and an advanced ranked enchantment skill, at the very least. Those kinds of weapons were very expensive and very sought after. But if a dark-aligned person tried to wield one, the best he could expect was a serious burn delivered via holy conflagration. Still, after their conversation had ended and Ed had left the priest to familiarize himself with his new chapel, he felt he had fared much better than he had any reason to expect. Having access to holy water and blessed weapons gave the haunt an advantage they very much needed against the kind of entities they'd be fighting. Ed looked over his shoulder to make sure he was alone, then walked down a dead-end tunnel next to the chapel. The walls of the tunnels were covered in the bright purple curtains that were slowly enveloping the entire haunt. He pushed a curtain out of the way to reveal a small door behind. He knocked on it 3 times, waited, then knocked another 2 times. Levy opened the door. She was wearing a black, drone-made tunic. She ushered Ed inside and locked the door behind her. This chapel looked more or less the same as its sister, but the altar was black and engraved with silver. It had no benches and no chimney, and there was a wicked vibe in the air, a tiny hint of wrongness, like spitting on a grave on Halloween.
You bought it?
Asked Levy, a mocking smile drawn on her face.
Zachary may be annoying, but he isn't dumb, Ed said. He knows something is up. The thing is, as long as he gets what he wants, I'm pretty sure he'll not care to look very hard.
He better not.
Zachary had given Ed a special kind of trouble. He was technically a member of the enemy. The Inquisition was powerful, unwilling to compromise, and would kill Ed and everyone near him if they ever uncovered his location. The priest wasn't a criminal, though, so Ed couldn't just kill him or jail him forever. At the same time, if Zachary ever left the haunt, he could risk the lives of everyone in it. Ed's solution, with Levy's help, was manipulative, and it left a bitter taste in his mouth when he thought about it. But it was also painless and bloodless. They got Zachary to help the haunt with little to no risk, but more importantly, they had given him a reason to integrate into the haunt's community in a way that satisfied everyone. He walked up to the raised dais. Atop the altar lay a small rabbit's corpse, its fresh blood marring the white stone surface. The tiny knife next to the corpse was stained red. The rabbit was worth a single experience point, and Levy had used that point to consecrate. Or was it desecrate? The altar to the dark, satisfying the bare minimum requirement to do so.
We haven't been consumed by holy and or unholy fire,
Levy pointed out.
So we got away with it.
There was no reason not to, Ed said. We didn't have to bend the rules at all, since it's all objectivity compliant. The light can't locate dark altars, the dark can't locate light altars. These two altars are in the same location, so neither the light nor the dark can use them to find us. This way, at least.
Ed sighed in exhaustion. Between Kes's training regimen and all the work on the dungeon, he couldn't remember the last time he wasn't sighing in exhaustion. But it was the good kind of tired. If he kept himself busy, he could forget the constant danger that loomed over the haunt. And the challenge kept him sharp.
A friend of Warlock Chazen knew of a mage who once bit the rules too far,
Lavey said in a conversational tone.
The mage was an enchanter, very gifted. She made a circlet that enhanced mind. Mind is the attribute you use to enchant better magical items, you see. So she put it on and made another better circlet that enhanced mind.
Oh, said Ed. He winced involuntarily. That was a hell of a great idea, and a part of him was angry he hadn't thought of it. The other part decided to wait for the rest of Lavey's tale.
All objectivity compliant, according to her, at least,
Lavey went on.
Her tower was in the middle of her city, you know, right in the center. It had a top engraved with gold sheets and precious stones, or so goes the story. It said she was on her 15th circlet when a mouth opened in the middle of the sky and ate her and half her tower in a single bite.
Ed smiled nervously.
What was the enchanter's name?
What he was thinking, instead, was, if the entire tower got eaten, how did people know she was on her 15th circlet?
That's the thing. No one knows. She was minor royalty in her kingdom. Her name's still written in 100 or so records and artworks. But no one can remember. It's all very strange. You can see her name written in those documents, but you can't read it. Not even her own father remembers her name. But everyone who saw that mount in the sky still remembers it. Some even saw what was behind it. But they won't tell. Haven't said a word ever since.
She gave him a creepy grin.
Point taken, Ed said. Don't make mind-enhancing circlets to loophole your way into godhood.
The teaching is don't push your luck, dung brain,
Lavey said, shaking her head.
Those are Warlock Chazen's words. The mouth didn't eat the enchanter when she made the second circlet. It didn't eat her when she made the third. You see, all the way to the 14th, she was thinking she had gotten away with it.
Until she didn't.
Until she didn't,
Lavey agreed. Ed looked around, almost expecting reality to tear into a gigantic, fanged, gaping hole.
How about we take it easy with the altars for a while, huh?
I couldn't agree more.
Your dungeon engineering has increased by 2. Ed's entire body ached with tension. Sweat ran freely down his forehead. He shook his head and brought his sword down in a vertical slash, his forearms burning as if they were on fire.
Again,
said Kes.
Elias, mercy,
said Alder sadly. The bard looked much worse for the wear. His straw blonde hair was caked with sweat, and his face was prawn red.
Someone end my suffering. Is Mama still taking deals? My soul in exchange for a 5-minute rest?
I heard that,
Kes exclaimed, bouncing back on the soles of her boots. In a heartbeat, she was in front of Alder, gazing into his terrified features with eyes like burning embers.
You just earned everyone another 10 circuits around the center, Alderloom. And keep a decent speed this time, or I won't count them.
Lavey made a whimpering noise, but the witch, wisely, refrained from further complaints. She was as red-faced as Alder, but her training mace didn't waver like Alder's did. She had recently earned her new endurance points, now at a total of 9 points, same as the bard's and one below Edward's 10. Since increasing a higher attribute took more time, Ed's own endurance hadn't risen yet. But according to Kes, his brawn would grow somewhere in the following couple days. Some steps away from Lavey, a half-sized spear trembled slightly out of Ed's line of sight. He had seen Kleck train without complaint since day 1, and the Batblin's brawn and endurance had reached rank 6. The strongest Batblins in the haunt were ranked at an 8 in those.
Edward, your form got lazy again,
Kes told him, bringing his attention back to the training.
Start from the beginning.
Ed's eye twitched, but he knew better than to complain. The problem with Kes's instructions, though, was that he couldn't maintain proper form when his entire body was shaking with exhaustion. He positioned his feet slightly apart, lowered his center of gravity like Kes had taught him, lifted the weighted sword over his head, and brought it down. During the third repetition, his slash gained a minimal sideways skew, though he couldn't even fathom what he had done wrong.
Please don't notice. Please don't notice.
Start again! Don't push your elbows like that next time!
The worst part about this part of the training was that Kes wasn't even teaching them how to fight yet. She insisted they had to get the basics right, or they'd develop bad habits that would cripple them later on. So, all this slashing and posturing, which they did after 2 hours of running and weight training, was just so she could drill into their heads the proper way for their bodies to act when in possession of a weapon. And drills required lots and lots and lots of repetition. Downward slash. Downward slash. Sweat ran into his eyes again. Downward slash. When Kes mercifully let the four of them crawl out of the training center, Ed felt that he'd dream about downward slashes for the rest of his life. Probably have nightmares about them, too. The three humans and the Batblin hovered next to a jar filled with cold water. Behind them, Kes remained in the training center, muttering to herself and fiddling with the equipment.
"Bards aren't supposed to train their brawn," Alder complained. "It's bad manners. We aren't supposed to go into combat."
"You're telling me,"
said Levy.
"As far as I'm concerned, not a single one of us four is built for direct combat."
"That's why we're running so much, right?" Alder ventured. "With a bit more running, and my nimble feet bardic utterance, I reckon we could outpace Heron himself if we had to."
"Heron can teleport," said Ed. "So, running won't help at all."
"We can't punch him either. Maybe we can get him to undergo Kes's training and he'll run away on his own."
The three of them chuckled softly, because at this point of their training they weren't really complaining anymore. It was just that talking about Kes's brutality was the way they relaxed after a session. The only one who didn't laugh was Kleck. The Batblin was deep in thought. His gray hide was almost black with sweat.
"Anything bothering you, Kleck?"
Ed asked the Batblin. Kleck jumped a bit on his feet.
"No, Lord Edward. I was trying to figure out how many days left until I'm as strong as Druzb. I need to be at least as strong as him if I want to protect the cloud."
Druzb was the Batblin's cloud master, their leader. From what Ed knew of the Batblins, they were a rough bunch, and when Ed had met them, they seemed to hate Kleck. They had left him to die, in fact. On the other hand, they had also abandoned Druzb.
"Kleck, man, you're already much stronger than you were last month,"
Levy told him worriedly.
"Take it easy, little guy. You'll break something important if you keep going at this rate."
When Levy had first encountered Kleck, she had tried to smash his skull with a rock because he stank.
"Scary lady, you'll break faster than the mighty Ranger Slayer," Kleck boasted. "Maybe you'll break another nail and cry again."
"You little shit. We agreed we'd never mention that again,"
Levy said. She smacked the Batblin on the shoulder, but her frown was way exaggerated, and her punch was more like a tap. The Batblin and the witch snorted, and their fake dispute died as fast as it had come. Ed recalled the vivid memory of Levy standing over Kleck with a rock in her hand. That had been a long time ago. Or so it seemed. Since then, Levy and Kleck had fought together, trained together, worked together, and something strange had happened to them. They were a family now, closer to each other than Kleck was to the other Batblins. Ed had no idea what magic of the haunt had allowed that to happen, but he recognized something special when he saw it. Something worth protecting. In any other circumstance, a woman like Levy and a Batblin like Kleck would never have met, much less become friends. Hell, as far as Ed was aware, this had never happened in the history of Starevos. Perhaps not even of Ivalis. Their interactions, more than the talents and the spells, was really magical. His dungeon grew, and it was hungry. But it was also fragile. Ed had to protect it, whatever the cost. He had to become stronger, yes, but it was even more important that the haunt and its inhabitants became stronger, too.
"So, Kleck," Alder said, "why all the effort? You work harder than anyone in your cloud, and you say you do it for them, but, you know, they aren't very nice to you."
"They're fucking dung for brains, is what you mean,"
Levy said.
"They don't deserve you, little guy."
"My cloud is... it's hard to explain it. This is how we've lived all our lives," Kleck said, looking at the floor. "We hid in the forest, hunted, ran from the wolves. Once in a while a bear ate one of us. It's life, I guess.
The three humans exchanged worried glances, but the Batblin took no notice.
But everyone does their part. Otherwise we'd all die. Druz bleeds us in combat. His wife, Stush, leads us when we aren't fighting. Clunk was our best hunter, but he got killed by a wolf last month. My father, Verp, was the shaman.
That name was familiar to Ed. He'd heard the Batblins mention Verp a couple times before.
His part was to inspire the cloud and to buff the warriors during combat. That was going to be my part, too, when I was born. But shamans are born, not made, and I was born without the talent. So I had no part.
Kleck smoothed his purple trousers with a trembling hand and refused to meet Ed's gaze.
Kleck, Ed started.
That was a long time ago, though,
Kleck said. He lifted his head, and Ed saw that the confident grin was back.
Now I've a part to play. I'm the Cloud's protector, and their link with the outside world. Ed, as far as I'm concerned, you and everyone in the Haunt are part of my Cloud, so it's my duty to grow as strong as I can to protect you two. It's what Verp would have wanted. I know I'm not much, but that's why I must work harder than everyone.
You know what?
Asked Levy softly.
I don't mind losing another fingernail.
Yeah. Me neither, said Alder.
Ed cleaned a bit of dust that had gotten in his eye.
And here I was, thinking that protecting you was my duty. Turns out that you've been protecting us all along, right, Kleck? He asked.
Right,
Kleck said, and gave him a thumbs up.
Your part is just to hang by your seat and look scary. I'll handle the rest.
Your attributes have increased. Brawn plus one. Due to starting specialized training, your untrained combat skill has transformed to melee, basic, one. Congratulations. Your athletics have increased by two ranks. Your leadership skill has increased by one rank. Your ancient Lord Aura's energy drain has been reduced accordingly. Chapter 12. Ask Them. The alleyway was dark and humid and filled with menacing shapes that swayed with the salty wind. The clouded sky was barely visible above the stone and concrete walls of Undercity's buildings. Taverns and whorehouses, the industrial warehouses of the big merchant companies, and the nameless shops of rare, and mostly illegal, ingredients that refused all clientele who didn't know the secret password. Undercity had thousands of alleys just like this one. Clement Candler had slept in many, which other beggars considered suicide, or at the very least, asking for trouble. Thanks to a streak of luck, Clement had avoided all the usual trouble that befell others in his situation. The slavers had passed him by, as did the Haligian Navy recruiters. The unregistered warlocks had taken his friends into their underground labs, and the vampire coven had murdered everyone in the whorehouse in front of his refuge a month ago, but missed him. Although, as his mother used to say back in Haligies, no luck lasts forever, my dear. Give it time. As he ran for his life through the trash-strewn alley, he mused that enough time must have clearly passed, since he was now shit out of luck. The shadowy shapes that had loomed over him for most of his life were now a new shade of menacing. The sounds of the rats, some of them as big as cats, scuttling in and out of holes in the walls appeared, to him, as the hooves of cockroach-shaped monsters lurking in the shadows, waiting for him to stop running so they could devour him. If only he could reach the safety of the Imperial District. A watchman squad could help him too, but watchmen never wandered deep into Stormbreaker Harbor's bad spots for fear of disappearing themselves. The salt in the air was overwhelming, and it burned his throat as he ran. His ragged clothing flapped against his skin, crusty with sweat and salt water. Clement was almost upon the Galleon's Folly. It was the kind of tavern he avoided like the plague for fear of the sort of people it attracted, but now he'd welcome those ruffians because they just might scare the creature away. A metallic crash exploded behind him. He turned without stopping to see a rat smash its way out of the sewer's half-open manhole and climb the walls of the alley like Murmur himself chased after it. When Clement's gaze returned to the front a second later, a shapeless creature covered in shadows was standing right in front of the alley's exit into the Galleon's Folly Plaza.
Not fair,
Clement thought,
I was so close.
My heartfelt apologies, friend beggar, said the creature. Clement noted that it spoke using the friend colloquialism of Staravos's country folk, but its speech affectation was of the higher class. I should have brought you in with minimal fuss. But alas, this is not one of my best nights.
Please, Clement begged, let me go. I haven't seen your face.
The creature stepped forward, and the trick of the moonlight revealed a man instead of the abomination that Clement had feared. Just a man, Staravosian, powerfully built and with a face that in any other circumstance Clement would have found attractive. But the cruel way those pale lips twitched around that trimmed goatee.
The creature I saw wasn't a trick,
Clement thought, as febrile fear took hold of his brain.
This form is the trick.
The man smiled as if to confirm Clement's suspicions. He took another step forward.
Please!
Clement hollered.
Please! Somebody! Help me! I'm being murdered!
He reconsidered. No one would face a killer for a stranger. Not an undercity.
Fire! There's a fire about! Fire!
Clever man, his pursuer exclaimed.
He wasn't being sarcastic. Clement's stratagem clearly pleased him.
The last two tried the murderer cry, and it didn't work well for them. Sadly,
more figures appeared behind the man. At first, hope flared in Clement's chest, but then he realized the figures stood deferentially to the man with the goatee. They wore red cloaks that swayed wildly with the wind.
There's a storm coming to Undercity, the man said. Everyone who can do so has taken refuge already. Everyone, of course, but us.
Muscles shifted under the man's skin. Clement saw the flash of teeth hiding in a part of a human body that had no place. No place for a mouth. Then the monster was upon him. Clement's screams were drowned by the downpour, and the streams of rainwater washed away the streaks of blood and carried them into the sewers. Blood mixed with water and tinted Nikolai's warm bath of pink. He passed a porous rock across his body to scrub all the little bits and chunks away. Then he made sure to clear his nostrils and pass a perfumed cloth across his nose. It was an action that would have gotten him laughed at when he was younger, but otherwise the stench of blood would stay with him for weeks. He lowered his body into the water, which covered him up to his shoulders. The tip of his knees broke the surface, and Nikolai wrapped his arms around them in a half-embrace. Steam rose out of the bath and engulfed the room. For a long time, Nikolai didn't move. Rollum had been right. Leading the hunt tonight had done Nikolai good. It had distracted him from his own mind. A welcome oblivion. It didn't last long, however. And now in the silence he could almost hear Lindis's laughter. Nikolai extended his arm to the copper tray by a side of the bath and poured himself a glass of Tsuika. He liked it warm. He made sure to fill the glass all the way and took a long swig out of it, enjoying the sweet, burning sensation of the drink as it passed through his throat. He had fallen in love with her when they were young, long before the rebellion. Long before the recruiters from Galtia had come for his brother and father to lead them to brutal deaths deep inside Staravosian countryside. She had been dancing a Spraveska during the harvest festival, bells singing in her toes, silk ribbons tied to her hair. She had it long in those days, swinging to her rhythm, jumping up and down with every step. The way her chest rose to the compass of her waist had ensnared Nikolai. 20 experience points. He'd come to her during a lull in the Spraveska, a lanky young man, barely a man in truth, with two left feet and less grace than a drunk horse. For a long time after that night, he had wondered why she bothered to share that dance with him instead of one of her many suitors. Years later, when she was lying by his bedside, he had asked her,
"He looked so grim and sad."
Lindis had told him with her laugh like silver.
Everyone was having a good time, but you only wanted to be somewhere else. And yet you came to me. How could I resist? The challenge of putting a smile on those sad lips did me in.
Even today, it is one of my guilty pleasures. Although you still have 2 left feet.
He had smiled with her back then. Now he suspected he'd not smile again. There were increasingly fewer reasons left to smile anymore. Not long after that Spraveska dance, the Staravosian army had come to his village and taken his father and brother. Nikolai's breastplate was the only memory he had left of his brother. He had taken it from his brother's broken corpse before burying him a few feet away from the devastated battlefield, seeded with death, that had been all that was left of Staravos' war with Halicis. Nikolai had never found his father's body. 20 points. 20 people. He could see her reflection in the dark red of his glass. Like in a dream, he rotated the glass to take a better look at her. Half her face was torn away from her, and her skull was visible. That was the thing with the fireball spell. It produced no flame. It carried pure kinetic energy, the same kind of punch to the face used to deal damage, only in higher quantities. But in close range, and at a certain angle, kinetic energy could burn just the same as fire. Burn and tear. At least Lindis died instantly and hadn't lived long enough to realize the state of her face. Another swig and Nikolai placed the empty glass back on the tray. Footsteps hit the warehouse's stone floor, distant at first, then closer. Only one man had footsteps as heavy as that. So unless a giant bear had infiltrated Undercity...
Rollum, greeted Nikolai. My friend, who comes with news. Hopefully good, yes? The gods know I could use some good news.
Rollum glanced at Nikolai's almost empty bottle and the glass next to it.
You're drunk, Nikolai.
Ah, but it never lasts, said Nikolai.
He patted sadly at his stomach.
There's a price to power, my friend. All for the cause. But in the end, it's the living who wind up paying more.
We get to live while others don't. And I can't even get drunk for more than an hour. The Diviner is here, said Rollum.
The news didn't bring the barbed pleasure that Nikolai would have expected, only a bitter taste to his throat as his heart raced. His vengeance was near.
Let's not keep him waiting. Making the trip here in the middle of a storm can't be a pleasant experience.
Rollum handed him a towel, and Nikolai stepped out of the bath, then went to his clothes, which waited for him neatly folded on a bench.
We caught 5 beggars today, even with the storm, Rollum told him. Thanks to your efforts, we are almost done hunting.
Nikolai nodded. Outside the room, he could hear the distant wails of the wounded. Chains rattled, iron bars shook, and men cried. To no avail. They were the living dead. That made Nikolai a necromancer in a way.
What about our friend Torst? He asked with scorn.
Still haunting the catacombs, just as you predicted. Without his daughter's blood, he's only slightly smarter than a common zombie.
Yes, Nikolai knew of wraiths. He knew of them just as much as Ione had known about Sephar's bane. After all, Staravos wasn't only Spraveska dances and harvest festivals. It was also the stories whispered in the middle of the night, those that the foreign bards never got to hear. Stories that served as warnings to children and adults alike about the dangers of dying with an unfulfilled oath or under the effects of a curse. The armor he was fitting himself with had belonged to his brother. Its engraved pattern was that of the now-defunct Staravosian army. The coat of arms at its center belonged to Duke Finnell's elite guard. Few seemed to recognize it nowadays, even if everyone had forgotten. He planned to make them remember.
Very well, he said.
He fitted his breastplate over a thick cotton shirt and pulled its straps so that the plate snapped tight to his body.
Let him stay there until we have need of him. What about his dear daughter, Gatsy Catlin?
Rollum handed him a green surcoat and a furred jacket stained with scorch marks and patches all over.
Brondon is searching for her. Says he'll find her soon.
Judging from the way Rollum's upper lip rose with disdain, Nikolai judged that his friend cared little for the thief's word.
We can't trust him, Nikolai. He isn't married to the cause like we are. Thieves like him love only what they can carry in their pockets,
Rollum said with a sneer.
For the right price, he'll sell us out.
Nikolai patted his friend on the back.
That's a good man's way of thinking. You don't trust him because he's obsessed with material riches, but that's the exact reason I do trust him. All there is to know about Brondon is right there in the open. We know what he'll do for the cause, and we know in what circumstances he would betray us. A person you can perfectly predict is not a man, Rollum, but a tool. And if a knife you're wielding cuts your hand, it's not the knife's fault, but yours. When we're done with our tool, we'll discard it.
Good man's thinking? Rollum asked.
You speak like you aren't one, my friend. With all you've sacrificed for the freedom of our homeland, I think you've earned the name. Do you wish to speak about evil? What about the Lothian, the man who put that thing inside of you?
Rollum shuddered, a sight that Nikolai had seen but a handful of times in his life.
If we must call a man evil, it's him.
What I've done, what I'll do, is all because it's necessary, said Nikolai.
He grabbed the longsword that his friend offered and tied the sheath to his belt.
Not because it makes me good. That's not my decision to make. Only history can judge me. And I only hope it judges me victorious.
My cousin would have thought differently,
Rollum said.
She followed you to the very end, and that counts for more than your brooding.
At the mention of Lindis, Nikolai scowled like he had been stabbed. Any other man he'd have killed for daring to use her against him. But Rollum meant well. They had grown up together, were brothers in all but blood, and understood the other's feelings better, sometimes, than their own. Nikolai finished dressing, laced his boots, and headed for the door. He smacked it open, with perhaps a little too much force. The wailing of the damned flooded the room at the same time the vapor rushed out. The distant cages were barely visible under the shadows of the warehouse.
Ask them, Nikolai told Rollum. Ask them if I'm a good man.
Like most mages for hire, the diviner wore a colorful tunic that screamed his profession to anyone that looked. Like any good mage for hire, he wore chainmail underneath. Nikolai could see the steel rings insinuating themselves at the tunic's folds.
Manfred Page, at your service,
the diviner said as Nikolai and Rollum reached him. They were in the warehouse's office.
Nikolai.
Unlike Manfred, Nikolai had no need for fake names. His name was common enough in Steravos that anyone looking for him would need at least a surname to scry him. The office had belonged to the past owner of the warehouse. The recently deceased elf had been a plump, decadent man whom Undercity's vices had corrupted away from the elves' famous holier-than-thou culture. Nikolai had left the office the same as he found it, to remind himself of the dangers of a world degraded by the influence of Haligis. He saw how Manfred Page looked at the hollowed ivory tusk lying over the desk and the gleaming steel needle protruding from one end. The diviner's eyes widened with desire, and Nikolai knew he was in the presence of an addict.
Excellent.
The best way to control a man was to provide that which he couldn't live without. Manfred took a hold of himself, quickly looked away from the tusk, and then gazed to Nikolai's eyes, to figure out if Nikolai had followed his train of thought, no doubt. Nikolai masked his face of all expressions.
I presume our contact has already filled you in on what we require of you, he said.
The thief said you wouldn't mind the extra fees, said Manfred.
The diviner, as it seemed, felt that this point wasn't yet clear enough.
With all due respect, what you're asking of me is incredibly dangerous.
Oh, you have no idea, Nikolai thought.
Manfred went on.
Experienced dungeon lords have ways to track divinations back to their source, and don't take kindly to being spied on.
Trust me, this dungeon lord is far from experienced,
Nikolai said.
I saw his character sheet. The entire one. Because I was his minion for a couple minutes. It seems like he isn't from our world, and Lothia hasn't had time to indoctrinate him into proper defensive enchantments. I doubt the Lothians are even aware of his existence.
Nikolai tracked the diviner's eyes back to the tusk.
However that may be, said Manfred, there's the risk anyway. And dungeons are naturally difficult to scry. My materials—
All you need will be provided for you, Nikolai said. He was losing patience for this conversation fast.
Their cost won't come from your payment.
This seemed to satisfy Manfred, which to an untrained eye would have appeared suspicious. If the diviner was so afraid of risk, why was he soothed by the mention of money? Rollum, who was standing by the office's door, grunted at the diviner, contempt clear as day in his expression. Manfred ignored him, and Rollum refrained from making any comment, which was all that Nikolai required of him.
There's one last thing, said Manfred. A moral cost. Our friend in common, the thief, said that you require the divining to be immediate. Isn't that right? But you only have a name and a general location. My advanced ranked spells need more than that to go on, so I'll have to use a ritual. A ritual with an experience cost.
What Manfred meant by speaking of moral costs was that a good mage-for-hire like him never paid those experience costs with his own pool. So it was Nikolai's duty to either sacrifice his own points or provide them in another manner.
Ah, that won't be an issue at all, friend Manfred, said Nikolai. My organization has a surplus of experience points at the moment.
He gestured at the warehouse that extended behind Rollum, down the stairs that led to the vault's entrance. The faint echo of the beggar's wails traveled into the office as if commanded by Nikolai's will. In a way, they were. But Nikolai wasn't in the mood to get metaphysical.
That's...
Manfred's pasty double chin went almost gray with fear.
That's... dark magic you're asking of me? If the Inquisition finds out about this,
they'll soon have bigger problems. There's nothing to fear from them,
Nikolai cut in. He walked behind the desk, opened a drawer, and rummaged through its contents.
Don't worry, friend Manfred. After you do this little job for us, you'll become a part of my family. And like Rollum here can attest to, I think there's nothing more important than family. For you, a gift, free of responsibility, to show you how much I care about you.
He handed the diviner the ivory-encrusted flask that had belonged to the elf. Manfred opened it and smelled its contents, but it was clear from his ravenous attitude that he knew what it contained. Pixie dust.
Hell, you can even keep the tusk, said Nikolai,
then tossed the pipe to the mage, who caught it mid-air like a man in the desert may catch a water flask. Nikolai and Rollum exchanged a brief, triumphant gaze that Manfred missed because he was staring lovingly at his prize. They had gained a diviner. Manfred would locate Edward Wright's lair for them, and he'd also find Catalan better than Brandon could. All for the good of the cause. Chapter 13. Undercity. The mess hall was mostly empty, but that was because Ed had built it to fit all the current haunt population, including the villagers and Laurel's cluster. It was connected to the kitchens and to the human quarters, which were empty too, although hopefully that would change before winter struck with all its might. There were about a dozen wooden tables all pushed together near the walls, with a single one remaining in the middle. The reunion took place around it. A Batblin-sized barrel rested on the center of the table, surrounded by clay jars and mugs for everyone. Around Ed, Andrina grinned proudly, while the ex-governor Brett sampled his second mug of ale of the evening. Alder, Levy, and Kleck were there, along with Yorche, Kess, Zachary, and a group of Batblins. Even Princess Tulip was present,
hanging by a strand of web from the ceiling. She was Laurel's envoy in the haunt while the queen was off fighting her war of conquest. Her job was to translate the spiderling messengers and to sample Andrina's ale, which was a job mostly self-imposed.
"I actually like this batch," Brett conceded.
His nose had turned red, like a clown's.
"The others, no offense, tasted a bit like Batblin piss."
Behind Brett, two of the Batblins stared at the ceiling and pretended like they hadn't heard the accusation.
"Too strong,"
complained Alder as he put down his mug, still full.
"A couple sips of this brew could blind an elephant."
"Or a Batblin,"
agreed Kleck, who wasn't drinking.
"Absolutely true,"
Yorche said while he poured himself a third mug.
"I always knew that Heligians couldn't hold their alcohol."
"I'll be glad to prove you wrong, Yorche,"
slurred Zachary, who was heroically trying to keep up with the blacksmith. Ed judged that the priest was about two mugs away from forgetting how to walk. In fact, the priest's agility was slowly draining itself with temporary penalties, which increased with each sip.
"Sorry about the extra punch,"
said Andrina, who wasn't sorry at all.
"I may have overdone it with the yeast, but Ed didn't want to wait another 2 weeks to make another batch."
That's right, Ed thought. They didn't have another 2 weeks. It had been a month since his encounter with the Wraith and Nikolai, with no news from Catalan. It was time to make a move, since he had mostly exhausted what he could do inside the haunt without money.
"Another batch? For what?"
asked Zachary.
"I saw the barrels you're keeping in the storage rooms. There's enough of them to keep us warm for months."
"What were you doing in this storage?"
Levy asked the priest.
"Why, I was convincing the Batblins to pray with me,"
the priest said. There was a strand of ale and saliva coming out of the corner of his mouth. Levy's eyes narrowed.
"What were the Batblins doing in this storage?"
The Batblins, now that Ed took a good look at them, were slightly fatter than when they had first arrived. He made a mental note to heighten the security in the kitchens and interrupted before Levy could curse the critters for stealing her food.
"Everyone, those barrels aren't for us. They're for selling," he said, trying to give his voice a confident edge.
"Selling?" asked Yorche. "I know Andrina, Alder, and you have been going off to the villages, but there aren't enough taverns to buy that much booze. Most farmers make their own anyway."
"That's why we aren't going to the villages," said Ed. "We're going to sell them in Undercity."
"You want to sell homemade booze in Undercity?"
asked Kes, who hadn't heard about this part of Ed's plan until now.
"You can't do it without a license. That's illegal." "Oh, what am I saying? We're criminals already."
Ed gave her a thumbs up, acting like her resignation was actually unconditional support.
"That's right. We need the money, and I know someone there who can help us move the barrels without raising suspicion from the watch."
And it would be the perfect excuse to make sure Catalan was doing all right. Ed didn't believe that Nikolai had sat idle the entire month, and even if that wraith had continued roaming the halls of the catacombs, the risk was too great that it would find its way into a populated area, where its endurance drain would ensure a massacre. But the money was an important part. With it, they could buy good quality silver to make weapons, as well as buy armor, runes, and extra defenses for the dungeon. He could acquire the scrolls that Alder and Levy needed to learn new spells, and he could hire the special trainer that Kaga's Kaftar required. And also pay their fees. Hell, he could finally pay his minions what he owed them.
"Why now?" asked Brett. "You haven't been around for the heart of winter, Lord Edward, but the storms are over and we're days away from the snow arriving."
The man shuddered as if he were already knee-deep in snow.
"Wouldn't it be better to wait for spring?"
Andrina snorted.
"Think like a merchant, Brett. Winter is the perfect season. The taverns in Undercity will pay extra for our brew because the farmers that supply them won't make the trip to Undercity through all the snow. Tavern owners could buy more stock from the merchant ships, but those are expensive."
She counted with her hand as she listed out.
"There are taxes, licenses, permits, bribes, all for some watered-down Heligian beer."
She grabbed her mug and held it up high.
"For a good, strong Staravosian brew. Oh, they'll pay a pretty penny. And do it gladly, because people will come to their taverns to drink it."
Zachary snorted, spilled his mug down his shirt, and collapsed to the floor.
"It is strong," said Alder.
while the drones carry the priest to his chambers. Kes shook her head sadly.
It's a good plan, except for one small detail. There's no way we can bypass Undercity's walls. They're too tightly guarded. For starters, the doors are enchanted to find dark-aligned creatures, including dungeon lords and their minions.
At this, she pointed at Ed and then gestured at everyone around him.
The guards of the towers have enchanted lenses to detect anyone smuggling anything illegal into the city. The walls are engraved with runes to stop climbers, and those are only the defenses I know.
People smuggle items and themselves into Undercity all the time, Yorje pointed out. Everyone knows it.
Smugglers have a system for that. They know people. They pay bribes. Are friends with the Watch.
Actually, said Ed, we aren't going through the city gates.
He let his words hang in the air for a moment, a bad habit that he had gotten from Alder's obsession with dramatic reveals.
Do you plan on flinging us over the walls with a catapult?
Asked Levy, raising an eyebrow. The Batblin group chanted nervously. They knew who were the minions that dungeon lords liked to fling from siege engines.
I'm pretty sure you'd need a trebuchet for that kind of altitude,
Kes told the witch. The Batblins looked even more nervous.
No, Ed said, we aren't going over the walls.
He gave them his best mysterious grin.
It's time for you all to meet the Infiltration Team Alpha.
I can't believe you prepared to infiltrate Undercity a month ago and refused to tell anyone,
Kes said. She and Ed arrived at the secluded hill where he had left his drone team the morning after escaping the Wraith with Catalan. The sky was gray and humid, and the grass was still wet from the previous rains. Ed's boots sloshed through the mud with every step.
I know, right?
Said Alder, only a couple steps behind them. The bard was panting from the long walk, and it would have been even worse without his recent increase in endurance.
What an excellent display of dramatic timing. Well done, Ed. You saved me quite a bit of trouble when I tell this story later.
Thanks, said Ed. I learned it from you.
Alder beamed at him. Kes muttered something in the language Ed couldn't understand. The woman looked at the sky, then glanced over her shoulder.
Hurry up with those. We're just hours away from snowfall.
About 200 meters away from her, the 24 drones that were pushing and pulling the carts loaded with 4-man-sized barrels scowled at her. They didn't need to speak to make themselves understood. If Kes wanted to hurry them up, she could help them push.
I'll pull your carts when you pay me, my lord,
Kes told Edward, who shrugged and raised his open palms. While the drones arrived, Ed willed Infiltration Team Alpha to come out into the open. He sensed them somewhere underground, but since their location wasn't part of his dungeon, he could not pinpoint it with exact certainty. The team responded to his call, but it took them about 10 minutes to appear, during which time the drones with the carts reached the 3 humans. For this operation, Ed had only brought Kes and Alder. Kleck would get mistaken for a Batblin slave, horned spiders bigger than a spiderling were obviously out of the question, and Levy had laughed out loud when asked if she wanted to come to Undercity.
Go to the mortuary place filled with thieves and assholes and dung running through the street?
Those had been her words.
Oh, I could do that. But I could also stay in my cozy new laboratory and play with the arcane secrets of reality itself. A little stitch, what a hard choice!
So, she had stayed, still mumbling sarcastic remarks as Ed walked away. Kes was here for protection, and because she knew the city better than Alder. Alder had joined because he had refused to stay away from Ed when he, in the bard's words, was begging to run into trouble.
And trouble is just another word for a quest, Alder had said. Unless it kills you, then it was really trouble, and you should have stayed home.
The grass trembled, and specks of dirt rolled away, getting progressively bigger. The ground there looked a bit different from the forest floor that surrounded it.
There they are, Ed said.
The hidden entrance collapsed and revealed a passage big enough to fit a small cart loaded with ale barrels. Covered in dirt, head to toe, in a way that made their purple tunics look black and brown, were the members of Infiltration Team Alpha. They looked proud of their job, which had taken them more than a month to accomplish. But accomplish it they had.
Excellent work, Ed told them, which made them puff their tiny chests out. I couldn't have found a group of drones better suited for the task. You did the haunt proud.
The drones cackled with excitement.
It weirds me out when you treat them like people,
whispered Alder.
I'm afraid they'll come to believe you.
Ed unsummoned the drones. He would resummon them back in the haunt when he returned. As a reward for their efforts, he planned to assign them to a comfy mining job, which was the drone's favorite task.
Well,
he said, walking toward the carts to help the other drones push.
We better hurry. Like Kes said, snowfall is almost here.
It was going to be a long walk through that dark tunnel. In some places of Undercity, night was as dangerous as walking naked and alone through Hoya Forest while covered in honey, character sheet in full display. Every morning came with the certainty that the Watch would find a new corpse floating down the canal, or that society would hear about how a werewolf had smuggled itself onto a merchant ship and slaughtered an entire family before either adventurers or the Watch killed it. People did not live in fear. Violence and death were as natural a part of life in the city as the taverns and the whorehouses. Most did not pay attention to rumors anymore. Bloodshed wasn't a worry unless it was your own blood being shed. And if anyone, mostly sailors, argued with the locals about the wickedness of the city, they'd get laughed at, and possibly stabbed to make a point. For all its vices, Undercity wasn't evil. It was corrupt, violent, and disgusting. But real evil was outside the walls, and the walls were meant to keep it there. South of the city, long past Galtia with its black mountains, were the wetlands, and all the horrors that slithered out of that primeval swamp. North was Haligis, and although no one would speak against the Imperial authority, everyone knew the Inquisition was a tad too happy with their purges. Thankfully, Haligis was an ocean away, and happy to leave Undercity alone as long as the tribute kept flowing and Alita's altars kept churning out prayer. Lotia was southwest, and everyone knew of Lotia's reputation. Better to keep those guys outside. Better to keep everyone outside, thank you. Undercity was a bastion of civilization in a world filled with murderous lunatics, most of which weren't even humanoids. Survival wasn't pretty, and it sometimes required ugly measures that made no one proud. At least that's what the slave traders of Shiva's Garden would tell you in between trying to convince you to buy premium bone nettle seedlings, still young enough to wail for their mothers with their eerie, teeth-filled plant mouths. It was winter night when the first snowflakes floated onto the shoulders of the revelers that stumbled out of the Azure Night Owl Casino. No one expected anything but the start to another normal winter. In the morning, people would wake up and go about their day while the street pastors dug out the frozen bodies of beggars and drunks and loaded them up into their carts. No one suspected the arrival of the Dungeon Lord, who, as of now, banked on King Gregory Avenue, had tunneled his way into the city and completely bypassed the wall's defenses. Undercity had dealt with Dungeon Lords before. They were mostly someone else's problem, with their dungeons hidden in the wilderness, occasionally coming out to raid a village or two until the Inquisition and their inhuman heroes dealt with them. All the merchants would insist that rumors of trade between the city's black market and the dungeon minions of Kael Arpadel were all uninformed lies. The treasury supported the merchants' claims. After all, they paid their due tax, mostly in the form of under-the-table bribes to their local officer. But tonight, it wasn't just a minion or a spy or two who arrived in Undercity, but the Dungeon Lord himself, and he brought with him a kind of evil that the noble treasury of Undercity detested with all its might. The evil of unregulated, unlicensed, black market alcohol production. Across the rich district of Milesius Heights, officers of the treasury and the diviners and their employ all suffered from uneasy dreams, and many woke up screaming and covered in sweat, their eyes searching the shadowy corners of their rooms for a monster that wasn't there. The absence of a monster in their chambers brought them little respite. It meant it was somewhere out there, roaming the streets, and very much untaxed. Chapter 14. The Welcome. The end of the tunnel brought them to the middle of a dead-end alley with its surface covered in trash. The smell of decay and humidity permeated the cold air that flowed inside the tunnel as Ed stole a look around to make sure the alley was empty of people. He noticed the small snow mounds, slowly growing in the corner. The ground was damp and quickly turning to mud.
"We better hurry," he told Kess and Alder.
The cold was almost unbearable, and it filtered through his armor, his jacket, and his fur-sleeved shirt straight into his bones. His hands and nose were numb, and Alder was shivering openly. He helped the mercenary and the bard out of the hole and left two drones inside the tunnel to close it, with the carts with the barrels still inside. It'd look too suspicious if they were caught walking with them, and they had nowhere else to hide them. All the other drones he had already sent back to the haunt where they ought to be.
"Careful using your powers here,"
Kess told him as she stepped out of the hole.
"The Watch employs diviners and clerics to punish anyone using dark magic, and your mantle is as dark as it comes."
"Figured so,"
Ed muttered. His only non-dark-aligned spell was Minor Order. In case of a fight, he'd have to rely on 3 castings of it and his improved reflexes, which was an excellent reason to have Kess around. Another good reason was so she could lead the way to the Galleon's Folly, where they could set up the meeting with Catalan. He wasn't out of tricks up his sleeve, though. Quite the contrary. His sleeve tickled as the tiny legs of the couple of spiderlings he had brought with him moved uneasily around his skin. Creatures of the forest weren't dark-aligned, they were neutral, and thus they wouldn't raise the alarm. They would be almost useless in a fight, but Ed hadn't brought them to fight. He'd brought them because he needed the extra eyes. Leaving the alley led the group out into a small agglomeration of streets with cobblestone roads and stout homes made of brick and mortar. The paint was chipped in places, revealing the dark brick underneath. The windows were closed with wooden planks, and the faint candlelight that hinted itself through the openings was the only light on the street, not counting the tiny sliver of moonlight that pierced the black clouds. Ed, who had lived his entire life in one modern city or another, fell prey to instant culture shock. Sure, he was aware that Earth and Ivalice had different levels of technology, but his mind had been conditioned for years to expect certain elements when dealing with a city, and those elements weren't present here. The darkness was one of those differences. Ivalice had no electricity, and Undercity's poorest districts couldn't afford magical torches. The walls that loomed over the buildings were like colossal shapes that ate a section of the horizon, a black strip without moon or clouds. Except in the watchtowers, where tiny sparks of firelight shone out like yellow stars in an otherwise cloudy night. There wasn't much noise. No sound came from the streets, except for his and his friend's footsteps, and he could hear the living people inside the houses. He heard heated discussions, couples fucking, dogs barking and cats fighting atop the rooftops, and children crying. A couple times, a curious head poked through a window's opening, but they quickly retreated when they caught Ed looking back. A hand removed the mesh panel from a window not 10 steps away from Alder, who looked up with wide eyes as the hand reappeared with a pot. The bard cursed Alita's genitals and jumped away a second before the pot's contents splashed against the ground. He jumped like someone with 10 more points in agility. Alder made a gagging noise. The bard covered his nose with a section of his shirt, and Ed and Kess seconded this motion when the smell reached them.
"You've got to be kidding me,"
Alder muttered angrily, looking at the window as the mesh panel was set again and the hand disappeared without apology or even acknowledging what had almost happened.
"There's no respect for bards anymore, I tell you. World's going to the gutter."
"This is civilization, Alder,"
Kess told him with a shrug of her shoulders when they had left the street behind.
"It has always been this way."
"I bet the people in Milesius Heights don't have to fear being bathed in dung while taking a stroll,"
Alder said, still fuming.
"People in Milesius Heights can afford to have their houses piped to the canal,"
said Kess, raising an eyebrow. They walked in the middle of the road from then on.
"Haven't you been here before, Alder?" Ed asked.
"Not here," Alder said, gesturing around them. "Constantina is big, Ed. Very big. You'd be amazed. It's almost a quarter of Galemore, and that's Haligi's capital. I reckon there are at least 50,000 souls living here, not counting visitors. That's the size of the Haligian army. It weirds me out, is all."
Ed said nothing, because there was little he could say without coming across as condescending.
"And most of those 50,000 empty their pots the same way,"
Kess told him with a smile. Unlike the bard, the mercenary seemed in her element.
"So,
If you see a small river flowing down the side of the street in the morning, don't step in it.
Her gait was confident. It ran against Ed's expectations, since he always thought of Cass as at